Welcome to episode 50 of Power of the Purse podcast. My guest today is attorney Sally Hermey. This is the first of a three-part series with Sally. Today's topic is caregiving. What is it? Who gives it? Why are caregivers reluctant to call it when it's time to get outside help? What are the signs when you need to take that next step? Having a team is crucial to success. How do you develop them? Why is it so important to take some time for yourself, the caregiver? And how do you hire an at-home caregiver? What are the pitfalls? What are the successes? What is the value of a support group? Yes, no, maybe? And adult daycare, good or bad idea? I hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. This isn't just about money, this is about life. And now the host of the Power of the Purse podcast, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not too long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years, until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise, and it was something I could not only understand but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't, until they were forced to, because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to an ongoing informative conversation about financial topics women should be more knowledgeable about. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is attorney Sally Bulch Hume, who is an estate planning elder law attorney and an author of not one, but six books. She grew up in Kansas. Her father was an attorney. She went to prep school in Kansas and Newcomb College in New Orleans. She didn't think too much about a career. She worked on Capitol Hill for 6 years, and she realized that it became apparent that a woman needed an advanced degree. She took the LSATs right after a congressman recommended that she learn shorthand, and then recommended that the male staffer go to law school. She went to law school in the 70s when there were very few women students or professors. She started a practice in Alexandria, Virginia, when there were very few women attorneys. When she decided to start a family, she withdrew from the partnership. She cobbled together part-time positions for a couple of years so not to have a gap in her resume. Networking brought in opportunities, which she never really applied for a position. One position led to another, with the grand finale, we should have a drum roll here, of 23 years at AARP, 8 years teaching elder law as an adjunct professor, and having written six books. So I'm pleased to let my listeners know that this will be the first of three podcasts with Sally on the topics of caregiving, which we'll talk about today. Secondly, getting the most out of retirement. And lastly, what to do when a loved one dies. Welcome, Sally.
Well, thank you, Lynn. I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to have this conversation with you and your guests.
I can't wait for this conversation because I know this is one topic that so many baby boomer women really want to know about. All three of these topics are very important in our lives. And as you and I discussed before we began this conversation, both of us are dealing with caregiving to spouses who are facing dementia and other diseases of this sort. My husband has a few others to throw in there. But it's a really, really critical conversation, and I thank you for doing this. So let's start by defining, what is caregiving?
Well, I think most women probably know that they have been caregivers for a very long time. They've been caregivers for their children. But I think now with most boomer women, we're finding that we're caregiving for our parents. We're caregiving for our spouses, as well as whatever caregiving we're providing to our adult children now. But caregiving
also,
can...
Also, I'm going to throw in there in-laws.
And in-laws, yes.
Yes.
Yes, been there, done that.
Yep.
Yes. So we're called the sandwich generation because we have caregiving responsibilities all around us. The generation ahead, the generation with, and the generation following. So, but caregiving, to define it, is pretty vague. It can be all-encompassing of a wide variety of things. Part of caregiving is just worrying about someone else. And part of the caregiving is wanting to make sure that whoever that other person is okay or is getting the best care that they can receive. Caregiving can be anything from just checking in with mom and dad, making sure that spouse gets to doctor's appointments are scheduled, making sure that everything's okay, whether you're close by or long distance. To on the other end of the continuum is kind of that 24/7 all-encompassing caregiving where you're providing medical assistance, you're providing guiding meals and nutrition. You may be helping with bathing and nutrition. You're helping them in the hospital. You are helping them with basically every aspect of their life. And this can be done either long distance, or it can be done at home, or it can be in some other community setting. So the range of what is included in caregiving is really pretty vast.
Yeah, and I think there's an important distinction we want to make here between caregiving from a professional perspective, people we can hire to do some of those things you mentioned, and then there's also the majority of people who are caregivers who are untrained, and they're usually family members. So my question is one that I know you and I have shared this. There's a time when the family member, as an untrained professional, has to recognize that the caregiving needs of the loved one is something that's far greater than what they can offer them. And so they need to say, it's time for me to get professional help, or, as we said, it can be care in the home or care outside the home. How do we make that determination of when that time comes?
At least for me, it was when I was getting exhausted. I wasn't sleeping at night. I was feeling overwhelmed. And probably knowing what I know about caregiving, I should have reached out for help a lot sooner than I did. Because we all know that if caregivers don't take care of themselves, they're not able to care for other people. So, one of the things that I think is very important, and I talk about in my book, Checklist for Family Caregivers, is to, before things get into a critical mode, recognize that you don't have to do it all yourself. There may be other family members who can assist you with some segment of the caregiving, such as helping with transportation, getting to doctor's appointments, or making the run to the pharmacy, or helping as a financial with a financial power of attorney in doing some of the banking and working with the insurance companies and taking over help with the financial issues. It may be family in addition to family members, it may be neighbors or someone else within the community or within the faith community who can spell you. I think one thing that's really important for caregivers to do before they get overwhelmed is to know how to say no, as well as how to say help.
Yeah.
So even before you really have to start thinking about reaching out to professional help, there's all sorts of ways that you should explore and call upon, and don't feel like you're imposing on other family members, friends, and neighbors who may say, oh, how can I help? Well, just have a list.
Check the ones you want.
Please go to the dry cleaners and pick up the clothes that have been there for 30 days before, because I haven't had time to run that errand. Have a list of things that others can do that's, you know, episodic. Reach out and find someone who can help you. Of course, when the family, I know in my situation, I have one child right here close, and my other child lives in New York. So, and most of my family, my husband's family as well as my family, those who are still alive, live way far away. So much of my help has to be done long distance. But you can be sure that I'm letting them know that when I need help and what sort of help that they can provide even from afar. But there obviously will be some point where you need more assistance than just your family. And that's, I devote a whole chapter in my book about building your team. Mm-hmm. And that can be your financial advisor or your banker. It can be the plumber and the automobile mechanic. It can be the superintendent in the apartment complex where your loved one is living. It can be your faith-based help that you could get from your faith community. It could be the barber that your spouse relies on. Build that team, both all of the various professionals who can help you do your job. And obviously there's going to be all of the medical people who may be involved in helping you care for your loved ones. So you need to really know, you know, the physician, the primary physician, the specialists, the nurse practitioners, the speech therapists, the occupational therapists, the music therapists, whoever might be it within the medical community that hopefully is not only taking care of your spouse or your loved one, but is also recognizing that they need to be taking care of you.
Well, there's the issue, taking care of you. I was just going to say that I know when you build that list and you build your team, so often that is much easier to ask people to do something for the person who is suffering with the dementia or whatever. But to ask somebody to do something for you, it's really hard. And I have a stepson who lives in New York as well, and I feel very reluctant to call him and say, hey, I need a weekend off. You know, it's just, that's hard to do, but he's been really wonderful about helping with that. It's not easy for him to be physically with his father because that's just not something he can do. But I find that, you know, the first time I asked him to do that, I felt really uncomfortable asking him because I felt like I should be able to take care of myself. Why do I need, you know, but then I went through that whole thing and said, no, this is what I need. I don't just need somebody to take them places and do those things. I need somebody to give me some space, some place to go back and recharge myself because I'm being depleted by all of this caregiving. And I think that is one of the things that most of us do not ask for because we somehow feel it's a vulnerability, it's a weak thing to do. And I just think that's insane. And having said that, I still find it hard to do this, to take the time for myself. But I think that is something we've got to move up on the scale of things that are a necessity for caregivers. It's to find time for ourselves, even if it's to go out with friends for dinner. And just that, just being out with some other people that do not require you to cut their food and think about, you know, all that stuff.
I mean, are they going to be able to get to the bathroom?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I think that is something that we really need to do something about that as a society and to just give ourselves more room to say, this is something I need to. I need it for me. And the other thing I wanted to talk to you about when you said about being present with the medical community that you're involved with the team, there's a big question here about whether you need to physically be there with that person or whether you can send somebody else, the neighbor who says, yes, I'd be very happy to take him to his doctor's appointment. There's a fine line there between wanting to know what the doctor says and being able to offer behavioral information that the neighbor can't possibly know.
Right.
And with people who have dementia, it's even more difficult to try to get somebody to tell you what the doctor talked about because they don't remember.
Right.
So,
yes.
I think it's one of those things where you have to figure out what of that list are the things that you can give up to people, to others, and what are the things that you must know about because you need to know.
Right. Well, exactly. And particularly whenever there's a medical emergency, and I just spent the last 3 days in the hospital sitting with my husband because we were, you know, waiting for this specialist and waiting for that specialist and waiting for this test and that procedure. And as you well know, things in the hospital do not run like on schedule.
Uh-huh.
And you're always hurrying up to wait and wait and wait. But I felt, I have to admit that I felt like I could not run down to the cafeteria in the hospital for the chance that that's the moment that the nurse
specialist.
Or the doctor or the specialist
yes.
is finally going to make their appearance,
mm-hmm.
and I missed it. So
yep.
I would try, you know, I just literally ran downstairs and ran back up, and of course waited for another couple of hours. But
mm-hmm.
I agree that for routine medical checkups, yes, maybe somebody else could go, but at least I'm not at a point that I'm willing to let anybody else sit in on those doctor's appointments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think that's the kind of stuff where you have to draw the line and say, I need to be there. But besides all that, I'm concerned about something that I'm sure you see all the time, even though you and I are both dealing with it personally. It's interesting that with the increase, dramatic increase, in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, more women are being affected by that than men. And if women are the caregivers, and we have more of the so-called compassion and, I guess, mental patience, the wherewithal to deal with this, what are we going to do when the caregiver is the husband and there is no recognition that that's something that they can do?
Well, I've seen some wonderful examples of husbands who are absolutely marvelous, generous, dedicated, devoted caregivers for their wives who have some form of dementia. Mm-hmm. But I think within our society, men don't have either the ingrained or lifelong experience of really being in that caregiver role to the extent that women do. And so I don't have any statistics on it, but I think in those situations where the husband doesn't really have those nurturing genes, mm-hmm. That it's going to devolve upon the daughter or the daughter-in-law.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I think that's what usually happens. Is there any trick or any magic to hiring some at-home caregivers that our listeners should keep in mind?
Having gone that route, mm-hmm. get recommendations from multiple sources, particularly from people who are using the particular service. Get recommendations from your primary care physician. Get recommendations from the area agency on aging. Get recommendations from other people in the community, and see what names or companies sort of rise to the top, and then do interview more than one if you are in a community where you have the option for mm-hmm. more than one, that sort of opening interview is critically important to get an idea as to sort of their philosophy of care. And I would want to sort of listen to how they're not only going to help the patient or the client, but what are they going to do to help you? Are they going do they have a practice of leaving notes? Does the management check in on a periodic basis, wanting to know, you know, how are we doing? What do we need to do? Formulating that care plan and then making sure that the agency recognizes that care plan may change on a month-to-month basis, and you may need more care or less care or different hours or different skill sets. And also listen for how they assign the individual caregiver. Is there going to be continuity? What happens if there just isn't good chemistry? How do they go about matching you with whomever is available on the staff? Of course, we do need to recognize that from time to time they've got a staffing crisis. You know, somebody's sick and they have to bring in a substitute or whatever. But it's wanting to be sure that they're listening to what you know as their care needs and how they are going to be flexible in making sure that the care plan is accurate, up to date, is serving the purpose that it should, that they're providing the services that make you happy and yeah. make the patient happy, and that flexibility, and they listen to you as to what you think that they that you think you need and what they can provide.
And what happens if you decide that you want to hire caregivers who are trained caregivers, but they're not affiliated with any agency? They may be
okay.
neighbors. How do you do all that so that you're within the law?
Yes, got to put my legal hat on.
Okay. Good.
Because that's that. You're taking a lot on more administrative burdens. You've got to make sure that that individual is qualified to has the appropriate training. You've got to verify that training. You also need to do a background check on that individual. It may sound over the top, but a background check is essential. Mm-hmm. You want to
how do you do that? It
varies from state to state, but you're going to have to go to your local police department and find out what the requirements are.
Okay.
But they'll probably have to it varies from state to state, so I just can't say. You're going to want to check with Adult Protective Services in your community to verify that there is no, that this individual has not popped up on their screen.
Is this on your checklist?
Yes.
Okay, and let me just say at this point, I want to make sure that people know that this checklist will be available on the website, Power of the Purse Podcast, and so you'll be able to get this if you need it. But I'm sorry, go ahead. I just
okay.
want to let people know.
Right, and then you have to recognize that you're going to be responsible for withholding their Social Security. You're going to have to get involved with withholding workers' comp and doing that paperwork and reporting workers' compensation. You're going to have to check with what kind of homeowner's insurance that you have. Is that going to cover the individual if there is any sort of accident? If the caregiver is going to be either driving your car or transporting your loved one in their car, you're going to have to make sure that either your automobile insurance is going to cover this additional driver or that they have adequate insurance in case they are involved in an automobile accident while driving your loved one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
those
are all
so
in the checklist,
and
I think I got most of them, but okay. doing the background check and you know, scoping out their individual, you know, who they are. Are they really who they are, and do they have the skill? Because we see so many incidences of caregiver abuse who come in and then ingratiate themselves with the individual, and pretty soon they're on their bank accounts, their powers of attorney, they're on their deeds. They're robbing them blind and using their caregiving as the entree for financial exploitation.
I think we see incidents of that probably once a month, you know, around where I live. It's a constant thing. I understand, and I'm sure you know, that you understand how physical abuse can occur. You know that we're all human and we all have a certain point. I'm not saying I do that. I'm not saying you do that. But when I see these situations where that happens and people are hauled off, you know, because they were taking care of Grandma Smith and something happened in the house and there was some picture of it going on, everybody's quick to blame that person. But I don't think unless you've been in that situation, you can understand how that level of frustration can manifest itself. And it's a hairline trigger between saying, oh, I get that, and this is where I have to talk myself off the ledge. This is where I have to not be reactive. I have to stop and think about this. And I think about that commercial on television. I believe it's the one that the Alzheimer's Foundation does, where they show the picture of the person sitting next to the patient and screaming without the sound, just the screaming, the frustration.
Yeah.
And then they show the person actually doing something differently and getting around the situation with a lot more grace and and temperament, okay? But I do, when I saw that the first time, I was sitting with my husband, who is the person who has the dementia, and watching that and saying, wow, do I get that or do I get that?
Yes.
Yikes.
Yes.
So the physical abuse I might be able to understand, but I think that financial abuse is a whole different story. And having people do that, you see it all the time, where someone, a niece or a nephew of a person who is alone, and this person, niece or the nephew, comes in to take care of aunt or uncle, whomever, and then you see them being hauled off and saying they stole $100,000 or more, and it all came from putting their names on a checking account or a savings account. And the person who has dementia has no idea any of this is going on. So it's not necessarily, I just want everybody to know, it's not necessarily that it's hired caregivers who do this, but it's also family members.
Right.
And somebody needs to be able to say, we need to take a look at that every now and then. And it can't be the same person who's got the power of attorney.
Right. And statistics that we know from Adult Protective Services show that the vast majority of financial exploitation is done by a relative rather than by a by a professional caregiver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know that there's an answer for that one. But any other mistakes that you see caregivers make that you wish they wish they would have known?
I think you're looking to. I think there probably are a good number. You mentioned five as we started this, but I think that learning to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Being comfortable with saying help, reaching out, getting the help that you need however you define your community. Being aware of the potential of financial abuse as well as physical abuse for a vulnerable individual from multiple avenues, knowing that you don't have to do this alone, and recognizing that there really is a vast amount of information out there for caregivers Everywhere from the Alzheimer's Association, from AARP. Of course, I will have to say there's lots of good information and resources in my book, Checklist for Family Caregivers. Mm-hmm. But I'm on the web a lot, looking up, you know, if there's discussion of a new diagnosis or a new medication that someone is talking about, looking for a support network. And I think that is one of the other, the sort of the final thing, which is sort of they all work, they're all interwoven. But look for a support group. I know my husband has kind of a weird kind dementia. It's not Alzheimer's. It's one of those other dementias. And I have found that reaching out to that specific support group of people who know what it is to have a sort of a strange kind of dementia. Those other caregivers, whether it's by telephone or actually an opportunity to do it face-to-face, support groups within the disease, and it may be cancer, it may be Alzheimer's, it may be MS, whatever that is, finding people who are caregiving for a loved one with that same disease can be a lifesaver.
Yeah. You know, I'll say something here that I think probably makes me be the odd man out, so to speak. But about 2 years ago, when my husband was diagnosed with, he has something called frontal temporal dementia.
Oh, welcome to the club.
Yes. Bingo. Okay.
Bingo. Yes. Behavioral variant.
Uh-huh. So when we discovered that, you know, people were telling me, oh, you should go to the local Alzheimer's support group, and they'll be very, very helpful. And their intentionality was that, to be very helpful. But I found every time I went, which is maybe 3 or 4 times, most of the people there were dealing with Alzheimer's.
With memory loss.
Yeah, but it was a different kind of progression, as you know, versus what you and I are dealing with. But I watched these people, and some of them came in with their affected spouse, and they would they had a situation room where they would allow these people who were the patients to sit there and wait while the caregiver spouse was in this meeting. And so I would go to these things and look at these people in various stages of the Alzheimer's diagnosis and the progression of it. And then we would go into the meeting and I would listen to people. Maybe there were 10 to 15 people sitting in a circle. And a woman who was trained by the Alzheimer's Foundation
facilitate.
Thank you. Facilitate the group. And every time I would leave there, I would feel so depressed and so, I said to my husband, not to my husband, but to somebody else, I said, I just felt when I left there that I wanted to take a gun to my head because it was just so depressing and so non-supportive in the sense that there was nothing there that I gained out of that experience that made me feel any better. It made me feel worse. And so I stopped going. So I am not saying that I'm telling people not to go to support groups because other people in other places may get something very different out of it, and it may be very supportive and very wonderful for them. But I found it to be just the opposite, and so I stopped going.
Well, and good for you to recognize that this was not helpful, and it was detrimental to your personal well-being, and you got out of there when, sooner than later.
And I think about what you said before about knowing when to recognize that you need help and to get the help. And I thought, that's what I said to myself when I would leave there. I'm supposed to be reaching out to get help here, and I know that, but I ain't feeling helped.
Yeah, so, right.
So it's so, knowing that and saying, okay, it's time for me to do something else, which for me was simply to say, I need time with other people. So I would make sure that I would find friends and go and visit them, even if it was for the day. And I would say, I'm going to do that. And then I would say, well, maybe I'll go to see something on Broadway for the day with some friends. But that's the kind of help that made a big difference to me. It wasn't the support groups. And I just want people to know, who are listening, that that is not the end-all and be-all for getting help. There are other ways to get help. There are other ways to feel better than going to a support group and knowing that maybe it does not support you to do that.
Right. And what I have found as my most recent lifesaver, I know it's both for my husband as well as for myself, is that he is going to adult daycare, which is working out beautifully. We had some issues getting started, but now that he is getting accustomed to the routine, he looks forward to going in the morning. It gives him that association and activity. Because I was concerned that he was too, you know, he's getting isolated at home. And I'm finding adult daycare is not only really working well for him, I can go to the grocery store. I even got my hair cut, you know.
It lifted
a lot of just that every moment, what's he doing, burden off of my shoulders. And I'm not doing anything fancy. I'm just enjoying the opportunity that somebody else is worrying about him.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a blessed relief right there. It truly is. Well, I'm going to have to say that we're going to have to wrap this up because otherwise you and I will have this private conversation for the rest of the evening. I do want to say thank you so much to my guest, Sally Hermey, who is an attorney, who is an elder law attorney and an author. And we are going to have two more sessions with Sally, and we will. I'm so excited to look at for the next two. But in the meantime, Sally, tell everybody how they can get a hold of you if they have some questions or want more information.
Sure. It's very easy. My email is just my name, sallyhermey@gmail.com or sallyhurme@gmail.com.
Okay. It's wonderful. Thanks again for sharing your time and your knowledge. And until the next time, thanks for listening. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to lynnsevans.com/call and sign up for an exclusive one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.